Hello, Xian Qi here, Executive Director of Byron Writers Festival. You're listening to the final series of our 2023 podcast, the Imaginarium series, recorded live at Bangalore Showgrounds on Arakwal Bundjalung land. This session, called Checking Out, is a contemporary conversation featuring Ellen Van Neven, Alison Pennington, Christine Ziwicker, and Paul Barclay. Enjoy.
Hello. Great to be here. Welcome to this afternoon's session of the Byron Writers Festival here in Bangalore. I'm Paul Barclay, broadcaster and journalist. It is wonderful to be here. Let me say we are on the lands of the Arakwal, Bumbamin and Minjungbul peoples of the Bundjalung Nation. I want to pay my respects to the traditional owners of these lands. They are the original storytellers of this region. This session is called Checking Out, and rather appropriately, earlier this year I checked out of my job. A good job, and the decision to leave was entirely mine. But after 30 years working for the one employer in a demanding job, I found I had the desire to see what life was like without work being at the centre of everything in my life. I was financially able to leave, so that makes me very fortunate. I appreciate many aren't. But it's also clear to me that many people are asking the question that I found myself asking: what is work in my life? How much of my identity, my time, my energy, my headspace, am I prepared to invest in work? And what am I getting in return? Millennials and Gen Zs, from my experience, are at the forefront of asking these types of questions. They also happen to face a mountain of hex debt, insecure housing, escalating rents, insecure employment. But unlike me, they are in no position to be workless. Many are questioning this idea of work and how much they're prepared to sacrifice for it. And I think in particular these questions became pronounced during and post the pandemic. And also, it needs to be said, we are living in times riven by profound unfairness and inequality, a climate catastrophe that we are in the midst of, an ecology at turning point. So all of these things, I think, are fueling this discussion, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. I've got a fantastic panel of speakers to help wade through all of these issues. At the end of the panel, Christina Ziwicker is a Melbourne... I hope I got that right.
Is yes.
A Melbourne-based columnist, consultant, feminist, writer and activist, and author of Leaning Out, A Fairer Future for Women at Work in Australia. Ellen Van Neven is in the middle, an award-winning writer of Mananjali and Dutch heritage. Ellen is author of Heat and Light, Comfort, Food, Throat, and a new non-fiction title, Personal Score: Sport, Culture and Identity. And Alison Pennington is the author of Generation Eft, how young Australians can reclaim their uncertain futures. Raised in Adelaide's western suburbs, Alison investigates economic issues facing working people, including inequality, jobs and the future of the fair go. Please make our speakers welcome. I think all of you will be signing at the book signing tent after this. Is that right?
Sure.
I think that's the go. I think that's the go. You all have books, and
yes,
you want to. So, you can continue the conversation with them after this. Look, so I thought I'd just open this up with all of you. I mean, are you all noticing changes in the way we collectively are thinking about work? And I wonder how we would describe this different attitude. Ellen, maybe you first of all, are you talking to contemporaries about these types of issues? What sense are you getting from your friends and colleagues about this?
Yeah, I think for my generation, I think for any generation, it's a conversation that comes up a lot. And I think a lot of us had big questions during around the pandemic about the work that we were doing and the conditions that we were working under and whether, we were getting, making the impact that we wanted to, but also doing things that were nourishing and nurturing us. I'll talk just a little bit because, I'm someone who, I come with this privilege of being the first person in my family to go to university, to graduate high school, and I when I finished uni, I worked for Queensland Government up until I was 25. I'm 32 now, and I made the decision to become a full-time writer. But I think that comes with an asterisk, because being a full-time writer, you're not just writing, there's a lot of other things that I do, a lot of sort of slashes and a lot of different hats that I wear to generate this sort of sporadic income that I do through writing, through editing and through teaching. And there's there's always these sort of ethical and moral questions that I have when I approach work and doing what I do, but also carving sort of space for myself to live more of a holistic life, just as my ancestors did. My people are neighbouring peoples to this, beautiful Bundjalung country on the north. And we had a really incredible lifestyle through how, we looked after country, but just how beautiful this country is and how biodiverse it is, that work didn't eat up all of our day. There was so much time for culture, for pleasure, for leisure. It's estimated, I don't know how they estimated this, but my uncle was telling me that, historians estimated that we worked four-hour days. That's a vast contrast to what is sort of the expected sort of 8-hour day that then becomes 10 hours, 12 hours for a lot of people. So
yeah.
I sort of think about, wanting to sort of spend my time with loved ones and outside and doing things that make life worth living.
Yeah. That's a great response. Alison, what do you think is driving these new attitudes to work and people questioning how much headspace, how much energy and time they're prepared to commit to work?
The collapse of collective organisation in work, the loss of unions, mass disempowerment, too many working hours, as Ellen was referring to, like working hours are exploding. And I think for places like Australia, which have in the last few decades developed a services industry with professional jobs and people have university degrees, we haven't yet worked out that it doesn't matter what type of job you do, you're still subject to pushes of exploitation, the push to work greater hours. Someone who employs you wants you to work more hours to make more money out of you. And I think it's a moment because in Australia we have this very classed system around education, and we were told that universities would be your ticket to essentially a freer life, a freer version of work. And I think in the case of young people who have moved into, maybe if they're lucky to get into good full-time jobs, they realise it's not all it's cracked up to be and there's all this extra work to be done. So I think there's an expectations mismatch. And this is leading to, because people don't have an outlet to talk about the fact that their job is not their whole world, this neoliberal idea of like your identity is how hard you work on the job, whether you tie yourself to the desk, how hard you go, how innovative you are, how agile, all of the stupid buzzwords, right? Like, I think we're realising that that whole edifice is empty, and what's on the other side of work is life. And what is life if you have no time to know what your hobbies are, what your passions are, what inspires you? And I think that's a big part of the work world, is actually also understanding What's the terrain that people aren't ploughing because they're working so much?
Mm.
And where, what does that loss of collective power and disempowerment mean for being able to work out the other side, the yin to the yang?
Mm.
So you know what you're trying to push back on. If you don't know who you are and what you care about, why would you unite with your co-workers in the workplace for a better life with more leisure time? And I think there's a collective fog right now about what we're doing.
That's,
in a nutshell.
That's so true. And Christina, you write in your book, you talk about the great exhaustion, this overwhelming sense that women in particular feel that there's just nothing left in the tank. What's causing this great exhaustion at the moment?
Yeah, so I think I'd pick up on what Ellen and Alison were saying, and just to set the context for this conversation, I guess what's driving these conversations about exhaustion, burnout, leaning out, bed rotting, all sorts of trends. I think people were mightily pissed off for a variety of different reasons. And I think the pandemic prompted a lot of questions, some of which you both kind of alluded to. And I tried to give voice to what was driving, in this context, women's anger, that kind of mightily piss off, and what were some of the questions that women had in relation to work. And I just want to caveat that and say women is, there's a lot of diversity and nuance in that term. So while I speak broadly, I want to acknowledge that. And so I wanted to tell kind of two stories about how this dominant strain of lean-in type empowerment feminism, which was very much in relation to work, had taken hold in Australia and really dominated the last 10 years of Australian feminism, and ask questions like, well, what happens when girl power grows up? We all remember, some of us of certain vintage, remember rah-rah girl power, and it's also called empowerment feminism. And the coalition government, like that really, that came out in Lean In for Sin, Sheryl Sandberg, came out in 2013, same year coalition government was elected in this country. And the whole concept of this individual empowerment was the solution to everything. Women could lean in, and we didn't really have to tackle the structural issues that were holding women back and different women back in a variety of different ways. That seemed very appealing, I think, to a right-leaning government, because then they wouldn't have to tackle those structural issues. And that was fueling that rage and that anger. And I think that the pandemic really exposed how 10 years of that had led to women having what I call kind of really fragile foundations of their working lives. And it fueled that rage, and it fueled a lot of those questions, and it led to a breakthrough. So I wanted to explore that in this book and kind of ask that question, well, where to from here? And I consistently, so I have a chapter in the book called Burnout Pandemic Style, which kind of really elaborates on that theme of kind of individualism versus structural change more. And people consistently tell me that that is kind of the chapter that resonated with them the most. So during the pandemic, this idea of women leaving the workplace in droves became a crisis. Women were losing work at far higher rates than men. And there was a study by Deloitte that suggested that 1 in 4 women were thinking of leaving the workforce. And this wasn't, women who were having kind of like, what's it all about, Alfie type privilege, I wanna, sail around the world or whatnot type questions. They were feeling like they were being pushed. This wasn't by choice. And they were being pushed by, it was just unsustainable. They were experiencing that great exhaustion that we talked about. Dr. Pudma Lakshmi, who's a psychologist in the US, wrote an article for the New York Times, and she said, it's not burnout, it's betrayal. And she looked at how these systems betrayed women in particular, lack of affordable childcare, gender pay gap, lack of investment or value attached to care and care industries. So I really wanted to explore those questions and ask, what would it look like if we tackled those structural issues instead of just simply saying to women, it's your wellness, you need to Mm-hmm. And I often tell this story
a bit more Pilates
ago.
And everything will be okay.
A bit more yoga, and I might be unpopular to say this in Byron Bay, a few more scented candles. But a couple of years ago, I got this press release for an international wellness conference, and they identified what the top wellness trends were for that year. And number one was feminist wellness. And I just thought, like, fuck me, what's feminist wellness? Yeah. And it was very much that. It was how neoliberal this idea of individual self-empowerment had infected the solutions. Because, again, you could, if we just had more Pilates and a pencil skirt in the workplace, everything would be fine. And we wouldn't have to look at, you know, the profound, you know, the racism, the ableism, the gender discrimination in our workplaces that make it unsustainable, all those, you know, structural issues. Why don't we look at that? So I wanted to ask that question. What would happen if we looked at that instead?
And it's not possible to have this conversation without acknowledging that. And Alison's spoken about the necessity for collective working together. You've spoken about the structural impediments. In a sense, though, Ellen, talking about the compartmentalising of work when you're a writer is kind of interesting, isn't it? Because I have lots of my close friends who are writers. I'm profoundly aware of the precarity of writing, but also really aware of these are passionate people who don't see their creativity and their writing in the simple, stark terms of work. They can't even imagine their own identity without creating. So just, can you just talk to that? I mean, you are that person as well, someone who creates. It's at the centre, I'm sure, of your life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you talk about that?
Well, that, you know, that landscape that you're describing is really fertile ground for exploitation. You know, the idea that us as creative people, whether we're writers, musicians, visual artists, et cetera, that we're going to keep doing what we're doing, and we're going to do it, you know, do so much unpaid work, and that there's no, you know, we know what the sort of state of arts funding these days, that there's not going to be that sort of, that real call to give artists a living wage, to sort of create those conditions that, you know, artists can thrive and not sort of have to worry about, you know, being able to put a roof over their heads, which of course impacts some artists and some, you know, intersections of identity more than others. So, you know, will it just be, you know, people of, you know, a higher class and stature that do get, you know, the opportunity to continue to create and continue to put, you know, weight behind their work and also have that belief? Because I think, you know, so often, you know, whether it's on, you know, the gender side of things or, you know, people impacted by, you know, a majority white, you know, sector, that that sort of self-belief and that determination can start to fade and fizzle in what you're up against as a living artist. But, of course, you know, I think generationally I think about you know, the people that have come before me and my family and, you know, my mother and my grandmother and the generations before that. And I think about, you know, the role of, you know, people like Aunty Jackie Huggins and Aunty Leslie Williams in terms of stolen wages, because that's still, you know, such a sort of blight of, you know, I was thinking when you were talking that there's still no remuneration for so many generations of particularly women's work here on this continent, and how that sort of sits uneasy as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think about that when you're talking there about your profession being ripe for exploitation. I think about that great Gillian Welsh song, Everything is Free, they were going to do it anyway, even if it didn't pay. And because there's something that's driving that work that's different to the motivations behind other work. Alison, you write in your piece about the anxiety that's caused from insecure employment that we know many, particularly younger people, but not just younger people, experience. And you say that for much of the 20s, you felt sick from insecurity, but you also write that when you finally landed a permanent job in the public service, you felt guilty and privileged because you'd got out of that cycle of insecurity. Can you talk about this and how finally having a decent permanent job gave you the headspace to think and write about the kind of things that we're talking about today?
Yeah, so I always feel a little less comfortable talking about myself, but I guess that's the point of an arts festival, right? But and I did write about it, so it's good for you to bring it up.
So we won't expect your memoir then.
The personal is the political, well, Alison.
Yeah. So much of my method has been, like, the reason why I write is because I tried to, it was a tool to make sense of my own life, and I had so many experiences of profound disempowerment growing up in a poor, you know, lower working class family that I reach for explanations of what's happening to other people around me and connect my life to others. So that's why I'm an economist, because I think it's like the ultimate form of connecting one experience to a mass and coming up with solutions to problems. So yes, I, like many, many millions of Australians, have an experience of insecure work. In all my early years, like when I started working, I was 14, 15, cleaning. I've scrubbed shitters. I've, done every hospo job under the sun. I've done pyramid scheme sales or everything. So in the book, I write about how it 14 jobs I worked, and I gave my all, and I was taught by my family to have strong work ethic and to be, good on the job. And not one employer saw fit to invest in me in terms of giving me, like, some security of income, some investment in my skills, some career trajectory. And I think even for me, coming from a background where I was used to unemployment, I grew up in a family that had that. But when you had work, it meant you had work. Like, you could depend on that job, and you could be really proud that you got a full-time good job. And I think a lot of Australians still see full-time, permanent, standard employment as, the good job that you can build a life on. But what's happened in, the last few decades in Australia is that especially all of the new services industries and especially entry-level jobs, which young people depend on, have just become this revolving door of insecurity and precarity. And, they've become the young people in particular have been told that these were stepping stones to something bigger. But I think we're at a point now where we can see sufficiently that the world of hospitality is severed from the world of career building, long-term, secure work. Mm-hmm. And there's this vacuum in between, and this is this mismatch of expectations, because maybe you did, 10 years of an insecure job, but you realise actually the next hook into the full-time secure world, you needed to know someone. You needed an in, you needed to be at the right place, the right time.
Yep.
And this is what I write about in the book, is the supreme collapse and failure of policy to build job pathways for people so they can have security. So, yes, I didn't know until I got my first full-time good job. I was 26 years old. I'm well into my 30s now. I know I look young, but but this, and it was an absolute, it was a revelation.
Yeah.
And I probably spent the first year of that job angry. I was so, so, so angry because I was buying for the first time, like, a woolen coat, a pair of leather shoes, and just standard stuff that you need in winter in Canberra, for instance. Mm. And I found my whole brain was changing. I had been in this constant state of defensiveness, never trusting, because always believing that if you work and you trust someone, they may undermine your material prospects. So you're always, it's always on you to get up, to keep your head above water. And then suddenly I was, enveloped in this beautiful institution of full-time permanent work, and I had annual leave and I had sick leave and I worked so hard, and I hated everyone who didn't work as hard as me. But it was still then the realization of, I've only just got into the institution that everyone has the right to feel,
yeah.
the right to secure incomes. And that's when I got to properly join a union and be active in my workplace to try and improve the conditions, because I needed that security
yep.
to begin with, rather than the fear of being thrown out on your ass at any point in time, which is how millions of people experience work at the moment.
I mean, that's right. I mean, there was no golden era of work, but certainly there was a more golden era of work than the era that you're talking about, and that was the period when I got into the workplace, where full-time permanent employment was the normal thing. Union representation across a fairly wide range of the workplace was a normal thing. And
yeah. I was thinking of when Ellen was speaking that there's a big discussion to have about how we create and protect jobs for, you know, people in the arts and all sorts of jobs that are part of the public good. But there's also the decline of the quality of jobs is also about the capacity of everyday people to have leisure time to be involved in the arts.
Yeah.
Like, I come from a tradition in working class, you know, culture where everyone had, it was expected you could pick up an instrument and you could be a part of a creative experience.
Mm.
And like my parents were in a folk band growing up, but they were also working full time. Mm-hmm. So there was, and I always have this question now when I'm freaking scrolling through my phone, Signals, two phones, and I'm working these long hours, and I think, where did they have the time?
Mm.
How did they do it? And they, you know, they were disempowered, but they got together with others like them and they made songs about it and they, like, danced about it and they did poetry, and heaps of it was naff, but it was good that they did it.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and that's, like, what about the...
Yeah.
What about why? How we need to fight for a society that gives the gift of the arts and the capacity for leisure and time with family and friends, making music for everyone.
Yeah.
And that's so much about work and how much power we have at work and how much time we can get away from it.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Can I just pick up on something that you were both talking about work that's, or areas of work that are rife for exploitation, as you said, Ellen, and jobs that provide a public good. Mm. So I have a whole chapter in my book called From Career Feminism to Care Feminism. Mm. And so here's an interesting statistic for you. Unpaid care work, which is largely done by women in Australia, is worth $650 billion. That's slightly over 50% of the GDP.
Mm-hmm.
That's the equivalent of three mining industries.
Mm.
And that provides a public good,
mm-hmm.
not to mention the undervalued and underpaid care work in our early years education sectors, in our aged care sectors, again, that is largely provided by women,
mm-hmm.
and in certain countries in the world, largely provided by women of color.
Mm-hmm.
Undervalued, and why is it undervalued? It's ripe for exploitation because care is something that we expect women to do for free out of love, in the same way that we kind of expect artists to provide art for free out of, you know, they love it. They're temperamentally inclined to provide it, but we don't value it. And that accounts for about a fifth of the gender pay gap. And so if we think about that as a structural issue, and if we think about the power that we have through collective organizing, if you just look at what's happened in the aged care sector, that has been, and just the sort of green shoots that I see for hope and things transforming and rediscovering the power of the collective and rediscovering our appetite to tackle those structural issues, I think that we've seen a real transformation in care and the value that we place on care, and that gives me great hope. So there was a landmark case that was brought by the aged care workers sector to the Fair Work Commission for a pay rise, and the new Albanese government slightly reluctantly, I mean, they agreed to fund it in full, but then it was like, how quickly are we going to do it? We're going to fund it in full now. And that's transformational. If we as a society start to value that and we start to recognize why it's so ripe for exploitation and the public good that it provides, I think that that's really important. And I often tell this story about years ago, I used to be head of media and communications at the Equality and Human Rights Commission in the UK. And this very earnest policy officer came to me once with this paper, and she was like, oh, Christina, I know it sounds really beige and it's not like the sexiest feminist thing. And it was titled, you know, The Undervaluing of Women's Work. Can you please, you know, try to get some traction for this in the media and kind of prompt this conversation? And I read through it, and it said that the undervaluing of women's work was leading to a caring time bomb. And that stayed with me. And I feel like during the pandemic, we reached the end of the fuse of that caring time bomb. And we're still living with the consequences of that massive, you know, the exploitation and the abuse in the aged care sector, the childcare deserts that we're experiencing. So now that it's a really, I think, existential kind of crisis problem, we're finally, I think, waking up to it and tackling it.
Can I just talk a bit more about the pandemic? And one of the things that the pandemic normalized, which was this notion of working from home. Now, for a long time, especially for women, the prescription to the problems that women, particularly those with children, faced was making the workplace more flexible. Now, we've thought that flexibility in the past meant the flexibility to work from home more frequently and not need to go into the office. But we now know, of course, that working from home has its own problems, including the disappearance of boundaries between work and home, the fact that it's been well documented through the pandemic, people worked harder when they were at home than they did when they went into the workplace. So I suppose my question is, if flexibility is the answer, and I think it is, what does a genuinely flexible workplace look like that doesn't create more expectations on people to do more work outside of the workplace?
I'll probably defer to Alison, because I know that she's done some really great research, which I quote in the book, about the sort of trends of the intensification of work. I think, and Alison will probably back me up, that that was happening before COVID. I think flexible work is not the answer. It's a answer for some people in some circumstances. Yeah. Over to you, Alison.
No, I mean, it's Australians are absolute sticklers for unpaid overtime. Before COVID, our unpaid overtime hours were every year increasing, and then the work from home phenomenon just led to a massive, you know, massive explosion. What is flexible work? Well, it's work that provides a secure income and then flexibility in hours. It's not a concept we have in the lexicon at the moment because business owns the word of flexibility in public debate, which is always about being able to hire and fire people whenever they want. And of course, that's no way that people can plan their lives. So, I mean, I'm thinking about the like this theme of the checking out, the crisis, the fuse, and women in work, and this kind of this moment that we've reached, and I think about, and maybe that helps us to bridge to whatever flexibility is. If we know that the blurring of work and home has done damage, and it has, it's not healthy for people, they need separation, then what does it mean to acknowledge that? Essentially, I'll go back to the feminist movement. Women fought for access to a paid work. They got in, but we never resolved what happens with the bulk of all of the unpaid care work, which, as you say, holds up the whole economy. And women have been doing two jobs, right? We call it the double burden. It's been going on for some time. But we still haven't really resolved what that looks like. So what does it look like to bring all of those people we have expected to mostly undertake unpaid work to uphold the economy into the mainstream economy as well? So they do both things. How do we resolve that tension? And it can't fall on women all the time. It has to be, there has to be a policy response. So one of the things I have a problem with is the solution to that problem, which is like, well, blokes just need to do more in the house. That's actually not the, it's not, cool, if he's not lifting a finger, then yeah, you need to do something, we need to do something about that.
Yeah.
But there's actually a problem of working hours, and also what is the role of government and policy for recreating and reshaping jobs that are actually fit for reality, which is, women work now.
Mm.
They can sell their labour, they can earn incomes. And if we think that that's important, which we do,
mm-hmm.
women are highly valuable workers, highly skilled, then we need to resolve this flexibility issue. We need to have an industrial relations system that puts into law that people have rights around being able to leave to care. Ones that reinforce and encourage fathers and men to do the same, because by all accounts the survey data shows especially young fathers and young men going into professional work, they want more than anything to share the burden. They want to mm-hmm. be carers, they want to be around for their mm-hmm. kids. But
they're twice as likely to have the request for flexible work turned down. Yeah,
I know my mate back in Canberra is the same. He wanted to be the primary carer for his kid. He's in the public service. And they literally turned it down because it's outside of the maternity leave provisions, right?
Mm.
So I think there's the flexibility question. It's about institutions. It's about redesigning jobs that are fit for people in real life now. But, of course, I wouldn't be here and it wouldn't be me if I didn't say that these things don't just drop from the trees. Like, you actually have to organise in workplaces
yep.
to fight for them. And, you know, people at the top don't do things for us. We have to fight for it.
Okay. I want to take a bit of a detour. Earlier on, Alison was talking about her parents getting involved in NAF folk music and so on, which leads us to the activities that we do outside of
Sorry,
work
Mom and Dad.
That give purpose to our life. You've written a book. Ellen's written a beautiful book about sport. Actually, I'd be more than happy to spend more than an hour talking about sport, but that's not the topic of this discussion.
Go Matildas.
But I did want to talk to you, Ellen, about, I mean, you play the beautiful game, football, what we call soccer.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just give us a sense, you obviously write about this in the book, what playing sport means to you, playing football means to you, how it is perhaps an escape from the other side of you, the literary, creative side of you. Yeah, can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, cool. And I just wanted to sort of just, you know, what we were saying about working from home, and there's been, you know, studies that have showed that our memories have also been affected in terms of, you know, working from home, particularly during the pandemic, where, you know, everything's the computer, you know, the kitchen, everything's in this contained space, and we're sort of working in this sort of shoebox. And for us black fellas, that makes a lot of sense, because memory is place-based. Mm. And so that separation sort of makes sense in terms of, yeah, we create our memories through, you know, being in, you know, moving through different places and having experiences there. So yeah, I mean, I guess I use that explanation when I, you know, forget what happened, you know, last year or what year we are in. But thanks for bringing sport up. Certainly, I think a lot of us sort of see sport, which I, you know, in this book, I really draw quite a big umbrella in terms of what I think sport is. So it's not just, you know, running around kicking a ball, but I think a lot of us participate in sport, fitness, and leisure activities, whether, you know, it's going for a walk on the beach, cycling, you know, doing yoga. There's a number of ways that we you know, we make time to move our bodies, and sometimes, you know, as an individual thing, sometimes in, you know, in conditioned environment like a gym, but a lot of the time also within a community environment. And that's something that is been such a valuable part of my life in terms of the people that I've met, and the environments that I've been around in terms of women's sport, and playing with people from all walks of life, and particularly, you know, a place where, you know, queer communities can gather, where, you know, people can gather in these ways and in these you know, and like you said, you know, we're all going to be watching the Matildas at 5 p.m. we can, you know, let this beautiful moment in history sort of fill us with, you know, joy and excitement and a sense of community. I mean, it's just been so heartening to sort of see that, you know, it's, you all probably know this, number one watched program on Australian TV this year, eclipsing the State of Origin, was a women's sports match, and the Channel 7 News is getting bonked down and the AFL is getting... because it's what this team symbolises as well, you know, across gender and story and absolute, you know, joy and excitement and skill.
Absolutely. When we were corresponding before this session, you brought up, and it's so true, the fact that Ash Barty was the best tennis player in the world, had just conquered an Everest, and then she just shocked everybody by quitting. Just, that's it, I've done it all, I'm leaving now, which went against all of the expectations. And then you also mentioned Naomi Osaka, the tennis player, who, though she didn't quit, put real limits on what she was prepared to do to be a part of that sport because of the toll on her mental health that the media engagements, and I don't know whether you've seen any of these post-match harassment sessions that professional sports people have to go through if they have the temerity to lose a match, but clearly that was... It was too much for Naomi. These are elite professional sports people who we kind of look at as almost like machines.
Yeah.
Talk a bit about what this is telling us. I mean, this whole thing about checking out, and it's, you know, it's kind of even moving into sport.
Yeah, I think it's a big conversation in sport at the moment. It's nothing new because, you know, when I was writing this book, you know, Ash Barty was this sort of, you know, I talked about how, you know, writing from home can sometimes be a little bit kind of full on. So I do a lot of my writing in the library. Go libraries. Long live libraries. But, you know, at the State Library they have Ash Barty's Wimbledon dress on display that she's donated to the library. And so, you know, that's where I sort of sit, you know, right next to this dress as a sort of, like, symbol that was like, let's keep going, let's try and finish this book. What Ash did in breaking our hearts by announcing her retirement, but also just completely doing this sort of amazing sort of checking out on her own terms, which we're just so proud of her and so back her up no matter what she chooses to do with her life. She doesn't owe us anything. I think that's what, you know, we're sort of figuring out is that sports people, they don't, you know, owe us their, you know, whole lives, you know, that they're then, like you said, they're not machines. And it's a really, really difficult space. It's a really invasive space and it's a lot of pressure that they have to go through. But it's not nothing new because when I was writing this book, I was researching Yvonne Goolagong-Cawley, who several decades ago made the decision to turn down a lucrative contract that would have made her the most highest paid female tennis player, maybe one of the highest paid female athletes at the time, because she just had a young bub and she didn't want the bub to grow up in this constant circuit, you know, environment, and how sort of damaging that was for family life and mental health. And so she, you know, at the time was, you know, and so many athletes do, she was sort of making her own rules and sort of pushing back with, of course, probably fear of repercussions. So I think athletes in terms of what they're doing in terms of the refusals, you know, to not, you know, potentially put themselves in places of harm, like Naomi Osaka. If you just sometimes, I don't do this often, but you know, there's so much stuff you can watch on YouTube in terms of like bad questions that tennis players have get asked, and you think, you know, what gives you the right to sort of ask, and it's such lazy questions as well. Mm. So I think, you know, we're definitely in this big moment now where we are particularly, you know, gender as well, and thinking about how we treat our athletes and how we privilege mental health and how we support people that do privilege their mental health as well as other things. And it's a great conversation to be having, much needed.
Can I do a rather maybe clumsy segue, tangential, and I'm not fully thought through yet, but I've been thinking about the phenomenon of political leaders who are leaving jobs. I'm thinking of like Jacinda Ardern, recent McGowan, Premier in WA. Mm. And that's also a perplexing, like someone, sports people at the top of their game tapping out. Like, why are elected leaders tapping out of the highest honour? And I think this is where it's not the best segue, but I think there's been a like serious erosion of our democratic institutions. And because people are less participating, less in politics, I think it's probably super lonely at the top, and the heat is immense.
Yeah.
And all you get is disaggregated immense heat through, you know, phones and things like that now. And there's no one holding you down and holding you accountable and keeping you grounded and keeping you going. And I think that it's a really unique, weird time in that sense. Like we have people individually checking out of their jobs because it reflects disempowerment, you know, collapse of unions, all the stuff we've talked about. But we actually have people at the highest office checking out of political leadership. And what does that say about the health of society at this point in time and our capacity to engage with the most important and meaningful things?
You know, it's really interesting to talk to people who've left after a year or so after they've left. The politicians are never more interesting than when they leave office. And they reflect on what it is that they've done. And I actually love talking to former politicians. Even those people on the side of the fence that I'm not necessarily supportive of have an insight, actually. Anyway, that's a bit of a...
They're much more indiscreet as well, so they say that...
But the other thing I wanted to talk about that's kind of obvious too, I've just come from a session, one of the speakers I was talking to, Jeff Goodall's written an amazing book on climate change and heat. And it seems to me that if we're talking about reprioritising how important work is in our life and thinking about why, well, part of the obvious explanation to that is that people are questioning what it is, especially young people, what it is to be living in a planet where the ecology is at great risk. I mean, I don't know how we quantify this as part of the discussion, and Christina, it's probably not an area of expertise of yours, but what do you think about this moment we are in now where it's existential? How much is that fueling this questioning of what work should mean to us?
Well, I'd say the word that probably has crossover of all of those domains is sustainability. So I think probably a theme of what we've been talking about today is the unsustainability of the constructs in which we currently work, in lots, and the unsustainability of those workplaces in lots of different ways, and challenging that and reinventing that. The same way we're looking at the sustainability of our way of life and the impact we've you've talked about plowing a different field. We've worked this ground really, really hard, metaphorically speaking, from an environmental perspective. And I suppose we've worked individuals in workplaces very, very hard. And that's no longer sustainable. So we're asking questions about that. And it has come to a point where it is kind of an existential crisis and people are voting with their feet or feeling it, but I don't think it's a sort of, it's a real privilege to be able to say I walked away on my terms and to have the funds to be able to sort of, you know, waft off into the sunset in your caftan and your sun hat and garden, or, you know, bless you if that's what you're doing, great. Hopefully one day I'll be in the garden somewhere as well, puttering away. But for many people, that's not, those aren't the circumstances of their leaning out. It's there's a lot of angst, stress, upset tied around that. And for different individuals, there's different push factors.
And I think there's anger, actually. Yeah. I think there's anger at the injustice and inequality.
Yeah.
That's the sense I get from talking to younger people. And the anger, quite rightly, in some ways, is directed at people like me, who are emblems of a series of privileges that younger people know, free education.
You have choices that they don't
have. Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. But I was also reflecting upon when I was young and the idea that when I was young, I was desperate to have a job that meant something to me, a job that reflected who I thought I was and a sense of how I understood and wanted to be in the world. And, you know, for me, you know, that was public sector broadcasting. I was desperate to be part of a mission that I thought aided a better world. And that meant that I didn't watch the clock. I mean, I worked my guts out and never really saw it as work. You know, this is scarcely a week that I would have worked where was 40 hours. It was sometimes 10, 20 hours, but I never resented it. I mean, it was, in a sense, it was the dream job. So I just wonder, what do young people make of this idea of the dream job? And is that something of a previous generation that people like me cling on to? Anyone got any thoughts on
it? I had a conversation with my daughter, my eldest, who's 14, recently. So I consider myself quite privileged that I get to do what I consider sort of meaningful or cause-based work that I feel
same.
Like
that
is an enormous privilege. Enormous privilege if you have that as part of your psychological contract. My husband is the same. He gets to do something that he feels like makes a meaningful contribution. And my daughter, my husband's a doctor, and my daughter recently was saying, well, I want to go to medical school. And I thought, oh, okay, because, you know, we've modeled this sort of, you know, community-oriented, cause-based sort of thing. And when I asked her why, she's like, well, basically it was security. She felt like people, and that gets to your point, Allison, about anxiety and the anxiety that young people are experiencing. So at the age of 14, she's already acutely aware of the uncertainty of the world that she's going to enter into. And she's made a calculation that people will always need doctors. So she feels like that will be, like, I hope if she becomes a doctor, she comes to it on other terms. But for her, that was that feeling like she was looking for security.
And this is the resource-poor environment, what it does to people's thinking. Mm. Like, they actually start limiting their expectations of life based on what they can see around them and what's going to give them security. Young people want to do good, meaningful jobs. They absolutely do. And there's nothing different about the way they approach work to the way that you approach work when you were younger, which was, like, get in there, get your hands dirty, arms up, whatever, we go for it. The difference is that the relationship of work to the next rung up the ladder, which I think is how we can see the fair go in Australia, is housing. What is the point of working and slaving if you can't get a house? And I think this is a key, the relationship between these two rungs being severed is where people start thinking more, okay, existential doom, what's the point? Add the backdrop of climate change. And, like, it begins to get a bit of a whirring, anxiety-inducing machine. And I think that's why, you know, it's upon us to think about not how it's difficult. We're in a time of inflation and there's all these calls on government to reduce spending. But actually we need to be thinking about how we can expand and grow and create new jobs in things like sustainable industries, renewable industries, public sector care work a bigger public sector, and this is the stuff that will enliven and give young people an opportunity to apply their talents, because they are the most educated generation in our history, yet they are far more likely to be in jobs where they don't even get to use their skills and capacities and knowledge and passion. And that's, it's, the contract is no different. The difference to your generation is that you also had the safety and knowing that your hard work would get you somewhere. Now you can just work and get nowhere. And maybe if you're lucky, you'll have a job, you know, servicing the people who are leaning out, right? Like the people who've decided to check out, maybe you'll like be serving them in an Elements resort. sorry, I had to say it. But like that's the reality for a lot of people, is that they have this capacity and they don't have anywhere to put it. And can I say one quick point? Because I interpreted this session as so much as well about like the internet and the rise of
Digital workers.
The alienation, the isolation that people feel, because there is, if I use the lens of young people, because I've written this book, Gen F'd, because you can't understand all of those big economic problems facing young people about jobs, housing, how to form a family when you got no money. Like they have all those problems, but they also have this extra overlay of this like parasitic beast that is like constantly drawing their time and energy and asking them to plug their opinions into it, telling them that the best way to connect to their friends is actually through a screen and through social media. Like we are reaching the tether, I think, for this. And a lot of young people know that it's bad for their mental health. They know it's disconnecting them from each other. And if we want to, you know, encourage all of us, including young people, to come together to build a better world, I think we have to get, like, we have to regulate ourselves out of screen time in the process of fighting for a better world, to regulate the big behemoths, the big international behemoths who are mining us for our thoughts, our feelings, our passions, and they're demobilizing us.
So this is the part of the conversation where we've got 3 minutes to go, where I ask, what do we do about all of this? Ellison's kind of given us a part of the answer. Christina, you've talked about this is structural. We need to change the kind of structures. So perhaps I'll get a response from you, Ellen, and then Christina, very briefly, you know, to get us out of this mess that we're in. What do we need to do? What does government need to do? Ellen, then Christina.
Yeah, I mean, the big questions, tapping into what you were saying, you know, the sort of, I guess, trend of digital minimalism, to sort of think about how much the internet is taking up our time and can we be strategic in only spending, the required time that we need every day, the internet, because you know there's been so many studies that show that it is really, you know, isolating us and bringing us further apart than it is bringing us together. So you know, more time to be in person. I think about the sustainability of the soul. I guess I think that's something that I think a lot about, and how, yeah, what is the future of our souls and.
In 2 minutes.
Yeah, I think sort of shed the veneers of this faux empowerment feminism. Forget if you've ever heard of Gendo Judo, which is, you know, just the right mix of sugar and spice and everything nice to get what you want, and still in a male-dominated world. Don't sign up for any of those courses about how to negotiate your pay, or don't power pose. Just like leave it all behind. And let's get back to kind of good old-fashioned kind of collective organizing, and which I think we are. Recently, there's sexual violence on campus has been in the news a lot. I had a piece in the Saturday paper 2 weeks ago about the issue. And writing that piece has, as somebody who writes and has written for 20 years about women's safety, women's economic security, writing that piece was really affirming. Because I see you, I see the advocates like End Rape on Campus and others who have just kind of toiled largely unrecognized. The persistence has been extraordinary, and I think that they had that really has paid off in the last couple of weeks, and they've elevated that issue, and I think we're on the cusp of change. And that's just one example. And, you know, while my last book was about how change is thwarted and how it doesn't happen, I want my next book to be about telling those kinds of stories, not just that one, but others, because I see it in so many places now about how change does happen. And maybe some of the people who aren't celebrities, you don't see at the book festivals or whatnot, who are doing that kind of coal-facing frontline, often uncelebrated work, but they're really making change in powerful ways.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find more of our festival conversations online at byronwritersfestival.com/digital.